Today's guest believes that we can be successful while having compassion for ourselves, others, and the world, and that one can live a life of abundance only so far as one brings real and meaningful substance to others. Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk, and happy to introduce to you today's guest, Dr. Nicole Cutts, who is a clinical psychologist, success coach, organizational consultant, author, and artist. My goodness, Dr. Cutts, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Dr. Brewer. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you are certainly quite busy. Tell us the difference between your work as a psychotherapist and your work as a coach. Is there a difference between the two?
Yes. Through my work as a psychotherapist, I help people with depression, anxiety, you know, other things that might be blocking them in their lives. And we're helping them through difficult transitions. As a success coach, my focus is purely on helping them to be successful in their life's work. And while I might sometimes employ some therapeutic modalities, the focus is really on removing blocks so that they can achieve their vision of success, as well as helping them to clarify what that vision is, to create a plan to achieve it, and helping to hold them accountable. So there are some similarities, but the focus is the main difference in terms of focusing on mental illness or lack of well-being versus focusing on their vision of success for their life's work.
You, as you heard me say a moment ago, you're a psychologist. You are an African-American woman. I'm wondering why you chose this field.
Why I chose psychology?
Yeah.
Well, I really just fell in love with it. When I was in undergraduate at Howard University, you know, like everybody, I had to take the introduction to psychology, you know, Psych 101. And I was just fascinated by it. Even prior to that, I had volunteered as a coach and a mentor in high school and with some young women outside of school. So I think I was just always interested in helping people. But when I encountered psychology, I was very fascinated by it. I was fascinated by what mental illness really meant. I saw it as something kind of mysterious in a way that maybe a little bit different than how some people might just see it as illnesses. I saw it as perhaps having another kind of meaning in the world, and I was just very fascinated by the study of it, and as well as drawn to the idea of helping people, you know, by sitting down with them and talking with them and getting to understand how their minds worked. So I just fell in love, really.
Well, you know, and so many people who spend so much time with their work are doing things that they have not fallen in love with. So it really is wonderful when you can do something that you really love.
Yes, yes. Well, I fell in love with psychology in undergraduate school, and it really helped to propel me into knowing how to study and how to be a good student. Prior to that, I had been, you know, an okay student, and, you know, you could ask my mom. She struggled a lot with, you know, getting these reports that said, you know, Nicole is so bright, we don't understand why she's not doing better. And it really wasn't until undergrad, when I fell in love with psychology, that I learned how to study, and I applied my fascination and my passion for that to everything. So I had a love affair going on with that. And then as I was nearing the end of undergrad, I had a talk with my dad, who said, "What are you thinking about doing next?" And like a lot of young people, I was like, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, what are your options?" And I said, "Well, an undergraduate degree in psychology, you know, isn't enough to be a psychologist. So I could just get out of undergrad and start working, you know, a job not necessarily in my field, or I could go to grad school." And he said, "Sounds like you better go on to grad school," which was great for me. I enjoyed that very much. And so I was following my passion, and then actually toward the end of my five-year PhD program, I fell out of love with clinical psychology. And but I decided to finish my program and then, you know, explore what I wanted to do. I mean, I thought I would still stay involved in the field, but I just wasn't as passionate about it anymore. And so I went on a quest to find my new passion. And if you have time, we can get into the journey, but I'll, you know, give you the short version and say that it led me to working with organizations, it led me to coaching, and then it actually led me back to incorporating clinical psychology into everything that I do.
Do you find, did you find that the fact of being a woman and an African-American woman had any impact on your training experiences, your work experiences, your practice experiences?
Yes. I mean, it definitely, I think, who we are in relation to the world always impacts us. I'm trying to think specifically how. I know one very specific way in my program, my graduate program, which was at the California School of Professional Psychology. I chose that school because they had a mission to understanding different populations and not just coming from that Eurocentric model of psychology. So I was drawn to that for that reason. But even within that program, you know, African-American students were in the minority. And, you know, we had many discussions around multicultural issues. And I know that, you know, that was, to me, it was good to have those discussions, but it did sometimes create some tension because of a lack of understanding by some of the students who weren't exposed to people who were not just white Americans. So that was one way. You know, I being African American is what made me want to go to Howard University. You know, it's the only school that I looked at that I felt any sort of strong connection to, a school that people wanted me to come to and seemed to want to nurture me. So it was largely positive, you know, really looking back, you know, those aspects of my identity were largely positive for me.
And that's Howard University in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
You work with both women and men, but it seems as though you have a particular focus on working with women. Why is that in your clinical practice?
Well, the focus on working with women is really mainly in my success coaching practice, which I do more of coaching than therapy. And I focus on women because I feel that, well, for one, being a woman, I think that I just have an affinity for us. And secondly, I think that we do face some unique challenges because of how we are socialized that has led many women to not fully embrace their visions and their passions and to be, I think women are socialized to dampen themselves down and to not express their full selves and their power. And, you know, it also comes from my upbringing, you know, of being a girl child and, you know, a young woman who suffered with a lot of the socialization that suggested that I should somehow dampen myself down or my spirit or my power because it was, quote unquote, you know, not really ladylike or would not be attractive to men, you know, which I think women are often socialized to think that that they need to have a man, they need to be taken care of, and they need to attract that man. And if you are a strong woman, if you are, you know, an adventurous heroine, that is not compatible with partnering with a man and therefore should be dampened. And so I suffered with some of that, and I've done my own work to break out of that. And so it's I really feel like it is my mission to help other women who were once those girls who were socialized perhaps out of being their true selves.
Being who they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're identified as working with bisexual, gay, heterosexual, and lesbian clients. I'm wondering if you have any particular concerns, given the current social and political climate, on the women and the men with whom you work, whether it's in your clinical practice or your coaching practice?
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of sexual orientation, I do put a focus on sexual orientation, not so much in my clinical practice. I also am an executive producer of a show on WPFW called Inside Out LGBT Radio. And on that show, we focus on everything from pop culture to politics, but looking through a more inclusive LGBTQ lens. And I myself identify as bisexual. And I think that that is, you know, a part of the LGBTQ alphabet that's often not represented, is often misunderstood. And I think that it's important in terms of helping to create diverse and inclusive communities and workspaces, because also when I work in organizations, a part of the work that I focus on is helping them to become more diverse and inclusive. So I have a, you know, special affinity for working with folks who are marginalized in society based on not belonging to the, you know, predominant gender orientation or sexual orientation. So in terms of your question about what's going on in society, you know, it's such a complicated issue. I think that we've come, as, you know, in America, we've come a very long way in terms of acceptance and understanding of LGBTQ people and issues. And I think there's still a long way to go. And quite frankly, I feel like with so many issues of inclusion and diversity and cultural competence, this current administration is doing a lot to try to take us backward to a time when many people in these groups, which, you know, are called minorities, that we felt excluded. I think that it's you know, like we've made a lot of progress as African Americans, as LGBTQ folks, as immigrants. A lot of, as women, a lot of progress has been made, and now I feel as if we are back in a struggle that I would have previously associated with, you know, many years ago. So there's a lot of stress, I think, for everybody in society, but especially for people who are in those marginalized groups right now, and that does come up sometimes in therapy and in coaching.
You referenced being executive producer of a program called Inside Out at WPFW. That's WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., correct?
Correct.
Okay. You certainly are busy.
I'm a Gemini, so I'm all over the place doing a lot of different things. I like being an entrepreneur. I like having a lot of things going on because I'm really not the kind of person who can go into an office at the same time, stay there and focus on one thing. And that feels deadly to me.
Okay.
So I really do like to keep it moving.
So 9 to 5, same thing over and over again. Totally not your thing.
Deadly.
Okay. Deadly sounds even worse than not your thing.
Deadly.
Okay. You have.
I will go in those places and help people, but I'm not myself staying in them for a protracted period of time.
I got you. You talk about Vision Quest, and there is a program, there are a series of books. I mean, there's just sort of a whole world that you have built around Vision Quest. As I understand it, Vision Quest, apart from the work that you're doing, is actually a rite of passage in some Native American cultures that was particularly undertaken by young males entering adulthood. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, that's the basis of the name, Vision Quest. And, you know, I differentiate it because these are Vision Quest retreats. But yes, the real Vision Quest, the real rite of passage, you know, as you know, was about young adolescents, usually males, going out into the wilderness, dealing with deprivation, hunger, you know, cold, being out there for a period of time until they received a vision that would indicate to them the path that they were supposed to take in life in terms of their work and what they would contribute to the tribe. So unlike what most of us have grown up doing, which is sort of having our parents say, you should do this, or society says you should do this, or we think what's going to make the most money, the Vision Quest is about going out and waiting to get a sign that tells you this is what you're supposed to do. You know, you're supposed to make canoes, or you're supposed to be a medicine man, or, you know, whatever it is that you are ordained to do. And so I borrow from that in terms of my vision quests, which are not about deprivation, but are about stepping out of your regular world and really listening to yourself and getting in touch with what you are supposed to be bringing to the world based on your unique gifts and talents and passion.
So your vision quest is not for adolescent boys trying to figure it out. It's for adult women who have already figured out some things, but they're looking to do what? They're looking to change in what way?
They are looking to do the work that they are uniquely put here to do, that they are most passionate about and that they are suited to do. And some people have an idea of what that is from a very young age. Some people, like me, might have a vision go in a particular direction and then might say, oh, wait, now I think I want to go in this direction. So it could be somebody who's transitioning from one vision to another. Sometimes it's women who have been very successful in their careers or in a particular field, but don't feel fulfilled. It's not, they're not living their vision. They're doing a job that they're good at doing, and that might bring something to the world, but does not leave them feeling fulfilled. And so many of the women that I work with might be successful in what they've been doing, but they want more. They want to leave the, you know, security and safety and boredom of that world to start to do work that is really fulfilling to them and that brings something to the world, their community, and to other people.
So it's interesting because, you know, in many ways, if you've said a moment ago, women have perhaps traditionally been taught not to want more. Not to be greater than they are in that precise moment, and perhaps to even live in deference to the male other. And mm-hmm. It sounds like what you're doing is saying that those are chains, those are prisons you don't need to live in. You can be more and you can do more. And let's figure out the particular more you want to be.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and I don't want to make it seem as if men don't suffer with the same sorts of messages. I mm-hmm. think that they're different. They don't come from, like, they don't have that, you know, sort of take a back seat and be deferential to women. But, you know, men are also socialized to do what's practical, let's say. You know, so you might find a man who is an attorney and he's making a lot of money because, you know, he really wanted to be a musician, and his parents and people around him said, no, that's silly. You know, you'll be struggling. Don't do that. And he might have made that decision to follow this, you know, more secure path and end up feeling completely unfulfilled and like he's, you know, that it's soul-deadening work. So it's really, you know, anybody can get in that position, but I do think there are unique messages that are given to a lot of young girls and women that shortchange them, you know, from being who they truly are.
Dr. Nicole Cutts is a licensed clinical psychologist, a success coach, and the author of a series of books, The Adventures of Isabel. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we're going to learn more about how to write your own heroine's quest. We'll be right back, folks. Dr. Cutts, before we talk about the process of writing your own hero or heroine's quest story, I'd like to spend a few moments with Isabel, the embryo goddess, as you refer to her, in The Adventures of Isabel, Book 1. Isabel is really quite something. And she has many important experiences, not the least of which is seemingly well-loved by her father and loved but by an emotionally distant mom. That's an experience that many people have. What's your sense of how that impacts Isabel and her journey?
Well, that's one of the early conflicts in the book that in her life that you see in Book 1 that's helping to determine her character and personality and her mission, really. So the effect that it has on her, she is an adventurous princess. She's not a quiet, demure, ladylike princess. And her mother and father both love her very much, as you said, but the mother's primary concern is to socialize her daughter into being a type of woman that she is, which is largely a figurehead, where the prize would be to get her own handsome prince or king, to basically put her in a golden cage, and where her domain would be, you know, the household and running parties and looking beautiful, but would not involve going out on her own adventures or leading, let's say, their army or their navy. You know, it's about you should be ladylike and demure. You should be educated to the level that you will make interesting conversation for a man and when you go to parties, and that's it. And the mother sees that as the desired life for any woman, and she is trying to socialize her daughter into that. And in essence, what she's really trying to do, you know, without trying to be cruel, is to put her in a box. And the daughter, Isabel, balks at this, and she rides her horse, you know, wildly in the field, sometimes even bareback, and she hunts, and she doesn't worry about getting dirty. And, you know, she consorts with, you know, men who come in a way that her mother just feels is scandalous. You know, she sometimes might even, a young man might come to visit and she goes off, they go off to ride horses and she might challenge him to a race or something like that. And, you know, not do the ladylike thing of demurring and letting the man win in order to stroke his ego. And her mother just feels that this is a big mistake on the daughter's part. And the daughter is struggling to be her own self.
That's kind of putting it mildly. I think the mother is pretty horrified.
Yeah, she's pretty horrified. She doesn't understand where this daughter came from.
Now, there's an interesting love story-ish that's a part of Isabel's first book. And again, this is something that happens to so many people. She falls in love with somebody. He's charming. He's handsome. And he's very much of a liar. And it really kind of takes her out for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he represents Prince Charming. You know, he's charming and he's well off and, you know, all of these lovely things. And she's fairly innocent at the time. You know, she's still a young girl. And so she falls in love with him and she believes that he loves her, because at that point in her life experience, she hasn't encountered the idea of somebody lying to you just to get what they want. So she believes him and she trusts him and, you know, ends up finding out. She encounters a very hard lesson that, in fact, people do lie. And people will lie at the expense of your trust and your love and your feelings simply to get what they want. And, yeah, I think a lot of young girls and women can certainly identify with that. I'm very happy for any woman who's never encountered a man that's been deceitful.
And I'm not sure that I'm not sure that anybody, male or female, has never encountered someone who's been deceitful in some way.
That's true.
That just kind of seems to be the way of the world in which we live. One of the things that happens with Isabel, that she recovers from, I mean, she does really find herself bowled over by the awareness of his deceit. And certainly for many people, particularly for women, when they find that they have been deceived or lied to, will see it as a reflection of themselves and their own worth. And it really takes some time for them to reconstitute themselves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, as a personal disclosure, I mean, I'm going through that right now, you know, and there is that temptation to blame yourself or to see it as a reflection of who you are. And even though intellectually I know that that is not at all the case, it's going to take some time for me to, as you aptly put it, reconstitute. You know, my worldview has been changed. My sense of self is affected, and I now know that, okay, we're in the process of recovery and reconstituting ourselves because, you know, for me, the idea of the heroine's quest is very real. You know, I know that my life is a heroine's quest, and things like encountering deceit and betrayal are some of the trials that we face, and the important thing is to come out on the other side with a true sense of yourself and to not be defeated by that, to not be defeated by the cruelty or the deceit or the poor character of another person, you know, that ultimately really doesn't have anything to do with you. And, you know, if that's something that women can take from this book, then I'm really happy. You know, they're not alone. People will let you down. People will purposely harm you. And all you have is yourself. And you have to know that you're valuable, you're precious, you need to protect yourself. If you need time to recover, that's fine. And it doesn't mean become hardened and never trust again. It just means to take the lessons that you can. But at the end of the day, the most important thing is not the love from another person. It's the love and the respect that you have for yourself. So that's something that I think we always can focus on and return to. Is the love and compassion and respect for ourselves.
Which in the moments that you're blaming yourself for what you didn't see, didn't predict, didn't know, that love and compassion has gone out the window.
Correct. Correct. And you know, it's and don't blame yourself for blaming yourself. But
exactly.
Focus on the compassion. Focus on, you know, a part of the challenge, and again, I'll speak for myself, a part of the challenge for me when I want to engage in self-blame is really a reluctance to want to be human and vulnerable. You know, I would like to think that I have more control than I do, but by the nature of being human, these things are going to happen. And I don't know if you or your listeners are familiar with the work of David Richaud, who's a psychologist, and I believe he's a Buddhist, but he talks about the five things we cannot change and the happiness we find when we accept them. And one of them is that people are not kind and loving all the time. You know, it's just a fact.
Right.
And so at some point it will happen to you, and how you go through that is what's important, and not to think that this shouldn't have happened to me for some reason, because that resistance to the reality is just going to cause more pain for you.
Absolutely. Talk to us about the process of writing your own quest story.
Well, I do have a little, a lesson. It's not really little. It involves a lot of installments, but a lesson on my blog, which is the Vision Quest Chronicles, and it's called Write Your Own Heroine's Quest, and it can just be done at any time as a free online course. And the first thing is to become familiar with the trajectory of a hero or a heroine's quest, you know, is to look at, I started off looking at Joseph Campbell's monomyth. He wrote The Hero with 1,000 Faces, and I'm blanking on what year now, but it's been many years out. And in that book, what he identifies is this story of the hero's quest that has been told over and over through across all cultures and throughout time. And we're familiar with it, even if we don't recognize, or we don't call it a hero's quest. We're familiar with it from things like Star Wars and The Wizard of Oz and King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, you know, who are on the quest for the Holy Grail. It's the story of the hero or heroine who lives in a safe, secure environment, and something happens to propel them out of that to begin their adventure or their quest. And, you know, we all know kind of loosely that you encounter trials and tribulations, you have to fight bad guys, sometimes dragons, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and then you face an ultimate ordeal. And in the end, the hero and the heroine triumph, and they win the boon or the elixir. And then the next stage is to return to where they came from, bringing what they've learned or bringing the spoils or the boon back to their people. So the first step is to become familiar with the stages of the quest. I named a few. It also includes finding magical helpers along the way, you know, crossing the threshold as you leave the safety of where you are. So once you become familiar with the arc of the story, I suggest that you see your life in that context. How do you identify with that? What is your safe place? What is your call to adventure, you know, which is the first thing that takes you out of the safe place? And it can be something that happens to you, or it can be something you choose. So something like the death of a spouse or a parent or a child, God forbid, can propel you out of the safety of the natural world to call you out to your adventure. Or it could just be a desire for something more in your life. So to first see yourself in that story and start to recognize, for example, supernatural aid is once the heroine is committed to the quest and they step out there, they're going to find magical helpers along the way. You know, and I'm sure, Dr. Brewer, you could probably identify with this. As you've been going through your life, you no doubt had people that have offered you help and aid and taught you things that were crucial in the next stage of your development.
Absolutely. And of course, sometimes the learning is not particularly what you want, but it's certainly
correct.
Something that can bring value to your wisdom.
Yes, yes. So, you know, that those recognizing that overlaying the stages of the heroine's quest onto your life is the first step in terms of writing your own heroine's quest. And then the next part is, you know, looking at the characters. And you can actually write the story as you want it to occur. You can take the events in your life and you can change them and write them in a way that's maybe more interesting or exciting to you as a story, or you can write it really plainly the way it is. And then no matter where you are in the journey, you can choose to write the ending that you want. And I think that it's a very therapeutic and healing process to go through that, to first reframe things that happen in your life into this idea of being on the heroine's quest, and then to choose your own ending, you know, because that empowers you, you know, even if you haven't gotten there yet. And I, you know, in real life, we go on many different adventures. I don't think there's just one adventure. We go on many different adventures and might leave the safety, go out, come back, and then go again. But you can write the story that you want to write. And one of the most important stages of the hero's quest is when you face your biggest ordeal. And I think it's good to even just get in touch with what that might be for you, even if you haven't gotten there, because it might be facing a fear that you've been dealing with for a long time that's been preventing you from achieving your vision of success. And so getting in touch with what that is and then writing the story where you overcome that, I think, is very empowering.
And you keep saying writing. Are you saying specifically writing down your story?
Yes. So there are two ways that I encourage people to use the idea of the heroine's quest. If you're the kind of person who actually would like to write a story, then to, you know, follow the stages that I mentioned and actually write, you know, come up with your characters. Who are you as a heroine? You know, like for me, Isabel, while she's a lot like me, she's the idealized me. She's that alter ego, you know, who's, you know, always brave and out there and adventurous. And so I connect to that person, and I use that image to help me in my everyday life. So one way is to actually look at your life in that context and write your own story. You know, you can go as close or as far away from reality as you want to, but that exercise of writing your story, again, I think is very healing and very empowering. The other way is to just simply, you know, in your mind, see your life in that context and think about where you fit into that and what you would like the ending to be. But I think there's something particularly powerful about actually putting pen to paper and writing the story. You know, you're actually engaging in forming the story versus just holding the image in your head.
Why is that therapeutic, though? What's the value of that?
Well, because you are feeling you're feeling the feelings that are empowering, and you are getting your brain to exercise in the direction that you want it to. You know, it's easy for us to feel defeated. It's easy for us to feel sad and to encounter things that happen in our life and take it personally. But when you write the story in the context of being on the quest, you actually get in touch with the positive feelings of, yes, this is an ordeal, and I'm overcoming it. And when you write your future vision, like if you take whatever story you want to form and you write your, and you connect with the character and you write the story of that character who's your alter ego succeeding, it helps you to envision it. You know, it's like creative visualization. It helps you to envision that success. And it also, again, exercises those, you know, for lack of better words, muscles. It's really the, you know, the synapses in our brain. It exercises them in that direction of feeling the success and the happiness and the fulfillment. And that's why it's therapeutic, because our brains have no problem feeling bad. You know, they're wired toward negativity. But when we actually exercise the circuitry to feel alive and empowered, then we're exercising those circuits and making them stronger as well, and predisposing ourselves to feel that way, which I think is a lot healthier way to feel and frame life than to see yourself as, you know, a victim or being defeated by life circumstances.
Absolutely. Dr. Nicole Cutts, clinical psychologist and success coach. We will be back in just a moment. Well, we've been talking about writing vision quests for the individual. Do you use this same approach when you're working with organizations?
I do in a way. I don't talk to people in organizations about being on a quest. The aspects of the quest that I think are just naturally occurring is I do help organizations to envision their ideal for the future, and then help them design a plan to get there. So that's the way in which it's similar, but I don't really use the framework of the hero's quest with a group or an organization. That's more for the individual.
The work that you've just described, though, that you do with organizations, sounds like it has the potential for being fairly daunting. But you've been able to do this work successfully for a while. What's your secret?
I don't have a secret. I think that organizations reach out to me when they want to change, and that's a part of it, is their willingness to do things differently. And I don't look at success as, you know, completely changing every aspect of the culture, if it was on a scale of 1 to 10 to 10. Especially when it comes to organizations, I think that you have to be satisfied with incremental improvement and change. It's very difficult to change culture, and that's what you're dealing with an organization. So I really look at any shifts in the culture as a positive thing, as successful. It is daunting when I think that I have to completely change the entire culture. But what I do is I help the organizations focus on not just what's not working. I use an appreciative inquiry approach where I also help them to focus on what is working and what's good and how to get more of that versus looking, you know, from more of a pathology model of what's broken or ill and trying to fix it. So it does help to change culture in that way, especially to where they can see what gives them life and what they value instead of focusing on any negatives in the culture. Does that make sense?
It does. And it actually opens up in so many ways. I would think the willingness and the interest to pursue potential change in the organization when you're looking at it from that perspective versus who did wrong, when, and how come, and how often.
Yeah, because a part of the reason why I work in organizations, and this is definitely connected to my mission and my thinking around, you know, the hero or heroine's quest, is that I feel like a lot of people spend so much of their time at work, but what they end up doing is kind of just parking themselves there and leaving their passion somewhere else. And the advantage of looking at what you value and what you're passionate about in your sort of, you know, 9-to-5 job is, one, you're going to have more energy and enjoy being there more, and two, you're going to give more to the organization, and as a whole, the organization will be more successful.
So you're more productive in the organization and probably happier in your life outside of the organization.
Yes, outside and inside, because, you know, the reason why I like to work with people at work and why I want to improve the lives of the individuals as well as the organization, because the organization, to me, it's made up of individuals, is if you're going to spend 8 to 10 hours or more of your life in this place, it shouldn't feel to you like wasted time or just time that you're putting in, that it's drudgery. I feel like even if this isn't the job or path that is your vision, you still should be able to connect with your passion in that context. So to look at, well, okay, you know, you've been here. There's all this difficulty with this organization, and it's a hard job and all that kind of thing. But I think people sometimes need to be reconnected or reminded of the value that they're bringing to the organization and ultimately to the world. So I get them to connect with, what is the organization's mission? What is your mission? And how do you connect with those two things? You know, like people who work at, I just had a person in class the other day who works for TSA. And he is a manager, and we were talking about how to engage and motivate his employees and the staff, you know, the people who are there on the line. And they are resistant to engaging in new behavior that would improve safety for travelers. And so what I was trying to get him to do is make the connection between working, doing this thing, making this change, and your mission of making air travel safer. You know, because people get in a job and they forget that that's what the mission of the job is.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get connected with, oh, wait a minute, I'm not just this person standing here saying, take your laptop out of your bag. I'm actually a very important person who is helping to preserve lives. So if a part of that is having a conversation with the traveler, then I'm more likely to want to do that because that's my mission. I get a little crazy about stuff like that.
Well, you know, it's actually, if it's crazy, it's a good crazy, because I'm just thinking, you know, I can't imagine, you know, having one of the TSA folks say, you know, take X out of your bag. And I might say, well, why? That's not whatever, and then them having a real conversation with me, and so I get it.
Yes.
And you know, I remember one time where I was asked to take something out of my bag, and I said, okay, but why do you need to see this? And mm-hmm. I was treated very abruptly, like, why are you asking me this question? Just do what I tell you. And that typically doesn't work with people anywhere.
One of the things is obviously to get them to see that. Sorry, go ahead.
One of the things that I noticed, one of the words that you use often is adventures. And it strikes me, because so many times we don't see our lives as being a series of adventures, which has a positive sort of energizing, hopeful, future-oriented feel to it. We see our lives as being a series of, oh, no's, what am I going to do to not have to deal with this? And so the idea of adventures in and of itself, even if it's something that you wouldn't necessarily choose, when you can see it as an adventure in your life, just that word is so powerful and shifts, I would suggest, the sort of the internal dynamic around discovering what that particular experience has meant or will mean for you. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are that was a very eloquent way to put that, what you just did, and actually helped me to actually articulate better you know, how that works. That's my first thought. My second thought is that, yes, you're looking at, when you look at your life as an adventure, it gives you energy. When you look at it as drudgery and those things that happen as negative, it leeches your energy. And I don't know about you, but I have a limited supply of energy. So I'm not willing to get it leached anywhere. Not to mention, it just feels good. You know, so it gives you energy to pursue your passions and your vision, whereas the other way of thinking will drag you down, slow you down, and decrease the likelihood of success.
I have to say that I'm not convinced that you have a limited supply of energy. You wear about 15 different hats. I'm sorry.
Well, you don't know about my recovery time.
Okay, that's true. I do not.
And as I get older, I find I have maybe even less energy. And so the ways that I choose to use it, I have to be a lot more strategic about it. And things that leech my energy, like thinking of things that happen to me as negative or taking them personally, I don't want to go in that direction. Resentments can leech my energy. Negative thinking of any kind. So I'd like to make a choice to go in a direction that's going to give me energy versus take away my energy. It just makes it easier, really.
It does. But, you know, another important thing that you've just said is that you make the choice. And so many times, I would say women more than men, but definitely both, have the experience, they believe, of not having choice.
Yes.
So how, yes. For the person who is listening who says, I don't know what she's talking about, I've never had a choice about anything, what's a way for them to think differently about that concept of choice?
The first thing I would do is recommend, there's a tool, the book The Four Agreements by Don Miguel Ruiz. I think that's a really good tool to help you to look at choice. There are a couple of the four agreements that really illuminate that. One is don't take anything personally. The other one is don't make the assumptions. But the don't take anything personally really helps you to get into seeing that what other people do actually doesn't have an effect on you unless you allow it to. Miguel Ruiz explains that everybody is coming from their own what he calls dream of the planet. So this person has their perspective and their story, you have yours, and just because this person's perspective and story might lead them to, let's say, treat you badly, you know what I mean? Like, suppose you have a boss who treats you really badly. You don't have to let that come into your body, mind, heart, and make you feel bad. It starts with seeing that there really is a separation between how you feel and what somebody else does and says. Short of them actually trying to cut off your air supply, they actually don't have the ability to change how you feel and react to things. And just that beginning of understanding, I think, can help you to start to separate between what they do and how you feel, and help you to see that there is a choice. But I feel like it starts with a tiny little crack, a tiny little chink, where you separate those two things. So I could say to you, I could criticize you, let's say, and your tendency could be to feel badly, but you can stop and use Miguel Ruiz's agreement of don't take it personally. You could stop and say, you know what? That's just Nicole's opinion. That's Nicole's thinking based on whatever. I don't even have to actually concern myself with that. I have the ability to feel good and to feel peaceful and to feel happy that has nothing to do with her. And that's where you start to see the choice in how you react to things and how you feel about things. And then it can grow from there, but you have to really keep practicing that kind of thinking over and over and recognize that it's the way you think about what happens that affects how you feel.
The idea that I can choose to take in your your criticism of me or not, there's a healthy way to go about recasting that concept in my brain, and there's an unhealthy way. The unhealthy way is, no matter what anything says to me about, or anyone says to me about anything, none of it's true, everybody's wrong, and I'm all good. That's not what you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about giving it the ability to make you feel badly about who you are. I'm not saying reject all feedback from the outside out of hand. I'm saying you do have the ability to consider it objectively and think about what feels true and right and what does feel like just completely off base, and leave that. But what you don't have to do is take it personally. So if you are my boss and you say, Nicole, you did a crappy job on this report, I could really be hurt because you did not say that in a nice way. But then I could take a step back and say, what do you mean by crappy job? Is there some truth to the fact that maybe I didn't do the best job? And maybe I didn't do the best job, but that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It doesn't mean that I have to feel bad. And the fact that you didn't say that in a nice way doesn't mean that I have to feel badly. I can say, okay, you know what? Pamela is not very good at giving feedback. That's on her. But what I'm going to take from it is these specific things to improve my report. And in the meantime, I'm not going to feel badly about myself. There's no point. There's no need. That leeches my energy.
Absolutely. Dr. Cutts, you know, I could talk to you for a very long time, but I can't. So at least not today. So I am going to ask you to give us your website for those who want to get more information about you, what you're doing, and definitely about the Heroine's Quest.
Best places to find me, my website for Vision Quest Retreats, where I focus on success coaching and events for women, is visionquestretreats.com. That's the best place. And then for my organizational consulting, also equally simple, it's Cutts Consulting. Cutts is with two T's, C-U-T-T-S, all one word, cuttsconsulting.com.
And when you say Vision Quest Retreats, is that retreats with an S?
Yes, it's okay. Retreats with an S.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today and for sharing your wisdom. Thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or Google Play Store. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is pamela@mindtalk.org. That's pamela@myndtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.